So we are on Judges Lesson 3, which is Judges 4 and 5. And before I forget, in 2 weeks, October, I think that's 15th, we have a very different day. And so I want you to put it on your calendar. It's going to be a day of all maps. So we won't be in Judges. I'll probably ask you if you have any questions about Judges and anything we've learned so far. But we're going to work on our maps. We're going to put them all together on one big map and then kind of talk about what to look for. After we do that, what?
2 weeks.
In 2 weeks. Yeah, in 2 weeks. Right? That's October 15th. Right? After we do that, if you have possibility of time, getting baby shoes, whatever you need, after that, so after class, we're actually going to Waterfall Glen. And we're going to actually have an orienteering class. Does anybody know what that is? Mm-hmm. Orienteering? So we've been talking about the word orient, right? To face toward God. So I thought, well, what better thing? We're talking about maps and hiking and all of that. Orienteering. So we actually have a ranger set up to give us a class in orienteering. Has anybody ever done orienteering?
No.
So a couple of you know what it is, right? It's literally going by compass and directions, finding a place. So it's actually doing in feet what we're doing in theory toward God. So it should be a really fun day. It should be gorgeous too, because it may be, you know, colored. I hope it doesn't go like this. And I hope it's not, you know, freezing and raining. But if it is, we're still going. So prepare.
From wind to wind.
So I think we have the ranger from 12 to 2:30. I think that's how it is. Which means after class, bring a sack lunch. We will probably eat here quickly, or maybe even on the way, depending on how we do with the maps. I think we'll have time to eat here. I'll gather a couple of vans so that we can carpool all out there, and we'll be out there by noon, and then do a 2.5-hour orienteering program. That the Forest Preserve is going to do for us. So I look forward to that. I hope you guys look forward to that. It would really be fun. And for those of us who've gone on the field trips together, it's really fun to do things with each other, and kind of we find out so much more about one another. And I think all of our field trips have been really fun. So hopefully you'll be able to do that. So Judges 3, or Judges Lesson 3, 4 through 5. I hope that you notice that the key word in these verses are arise, awake, arise, awake. It says it over and over and over and over again. If you haven't noticed that, go back and look. That is definitely the key verse, the key word in these chapters. What I'd like to do is remember. We need to remember kind of what we've done already, what we've seen God doing, and what we've seen the people of Israel doing, because that's always where we are as well. So we need to remember that God is redeeming his people in order to redeem all people. So he's redeeming from, always remember this. Sometimes the gospel gets cut off and we say he saved us from. But we forget the bigger deal is actually that he's saving us to something. And that's why we always go back to Genesis 1. If you start with Genesis 3, which I see so many people do, you lose half the story. You lose the telos of humanity, the end goal of humanity, and actually the big picture of what God is doing. So he is redeeming from following our own broken selves. And remember, we talked about our broken selves means, in a psychological way, that our bios, our physical desires and wants and needs, and our psuche, our will, our desires and emotions, and our heart, kind of, are separated from what gives it all life. And that is what? What's the Greek word?
Zoe.
It's separated from Zoe, which is the vivifying life, the breath that gives life, which is the breath of Genesis 2 that God breathes into Adam and Eve. He also breathed into us. It didn't stop. He always gives breath to every human being that lives. So he's saving us from being separated from that Zoe, from not tapping into that Zoe anymore. But he's saving us to our original state of image bearers. Image bearers who create, who rule the same way he does. So we're going to talk a lot about power today. So we need to always substantiate what it is that God intended us to have power over or rule. So the word power is just what we're going to use. But perhaps when we use God's type of power, if we use rule, maybe it'll delineate for us the difference. But remember how God rules, how God creates. That's the same thing for God. He rules and he creates the exact same thing. And he does it by, and you shouldn't have to look at your notes by this time, right? He does it in three ways. Number one,
naming
worth. Number two,
tending.
And number three,
multiplying
toward flourishing. So that's what he is redeeming us to. He is restoring us to that. So the saving from our brokenness is a big deal. But if that's all he did, it doesn't help us. Because if he saves us from brokenness and not to anything, we're still in the desert wandering around, broken. So the saving from brokenness is a big deal, but the saving to is what the goal is, that he is saving us to being restored, to being very reflective image bearers, to being image bearers that fulfill the potential for what he made us to be. How is he doing it? He's always doing it by keeping covenant. He's always, and this is what God is always doing. This is what God is always up to. So when you wonder what's going on in the world, the things seem to be collapsing, what's God up to? Is he ignoring it? Is he just letting everybody do what they want to do? No, he is always redeeming his people so that they can help to redeem the world. He is always redeeming from brokenness to wholeness in image bearing. That's what he's always doing. And that's why Judges is so important, because when we think, when hard things come, when battles come, when we see the world falling apart, we think, and this is what we always think, oh, everyone's just horrible, just horrible, just horrible. There's nothing good, there's nothing good. No. God knew that these would be happening, and he's using these to actually bring redemption. And I think by the time you're finished with Judges, you're going to realize battles are good. Battles help us to come to the choice on our own that his way of life is actually life. So he keeps covenant by two things it tells us in Judges. By testing us, which is that proving, that bringing up the dross, bringing up the impurities out of our silver. So he keeps covenant by trying us, by proving us, by testing us, by putting us in the fire. And he keeps covenant by teaching us war. He teaches us war. He teaches us how to fight those broken desires of Suke and Bios, letting Suke and Bios lead, because they have broken desires. We have desires that are true and real. It says that eternity is planted in everyone's heart. We just don't know how to access it. And so he's going to teach us how to not let Bios and Suke lead and access that Zoe. So we have to remember that. Every single time we go into a new chapter of Judges, we have to remember this is what God's doing. He's doing this every single chapter. He is redeeming his people. He's bringing them to a fullness of image, but freely, that they would choose that. The other thing that we're always going to kind of go back to is what gods have been encountered in the battles. So that there's a interesting thing about Judges. Remember, we look at the enemy and we look at what Israel is being oppressed by, and we know that's what Israel was living. That they're just reflecting what they were living under as their idol. So last week, we talked about Moab and Eglon. What was the god or the idol that was being pursued there?
Feeding themselves.
Yeah, feeding themselves. Self-satisfaction. And I like that better, feeding themselves. I'm just going to feed myself. And I'm going to feed myself in order to get comfort, to get status, profit myself in some way or another. That's self-satisfaction. That's feeding myself. And that's really, and that's another thing. It should be very visual for you. You see Eglon sitting on the throne, this big, huge, fat, greasy man. That's the picture of the god of self-satisfaction. And for us, same thing, self-satisfaction. That is the god that we really talked about in the first couple chapters. And for them, it was through food, through wealth, through excess of anything. And we do the same things. Sometimes we do it the opposite way, though, right? Instead of feeding ourselves lots of food, we feed ourselves no food or only certain foods, or we restrict, which is an aberration of what God gave us food for in the first place. So both ends. So excess. It's excess of food or excess of not having food. All right, so that's kind of where we've been. Now where are we going in Judges 4? We're really going to talk about sleeping and waking here, since that's the key word, arise, awake. And we're going to talk about the dangers of sleeping. And first we're going to look at the enemies then. What's going on in Israel at the time? So the enemy we have here is Canaan. Now this is going to be the enemy dotted throughout, because the Canaanites are the biggest group of people in Canaan, obviously. And they infiltrate a lot of the other people. So sometimes when we hear Hivites and those kind of, they're actually considered Canaanites as well. So you're going to hear Canaanites a lot. But Canaanites, the actual group of Canaanites, it tells us in Judges, had how many chariots?
900.
Now, if you know anything about the numbers in the Old Testament, you've got to think much smaller than we think today, because the number of people was much smaller. 900 chariots? That's like unthinkable. 900 chariots is unthinkable. And think of chariots as tanks. I mean, that's what they were for that time. So Canaan was especially known for the extreme power they had. Anytime you see chariots, it's always man's power. Hazor, which is where Jabin, the king, comes from, is the biggest and the most important city in all of Canaan. So that just tells you right there. As soon as you hear Jabin from Hazor, this is like the top. This is like the most powerful city, the most powerful man, the most powerful army, the most powerful people. And because they were the most powerful, they were also the most oppressive. They were severely, severely oppressive. All power is like that. The more powerful, the more oppressive. We notice, and I'm just trying to take out things what you would have read, and so that you begin to you're able to begin to read things and go, what does that mean about that people? So the end of chapter 5, we have Sisera's mother talking. You know what I'm talking about? So she's talking about, she's waiting at the window, waiting for her son Sisera. And she talks about, her maids say, right now, this is what they're doing. This is where I get this from. What did they value? Because what are they doing? They're getting their spoil. And their spoil, they're not even talking about like material goods. What are they talking about? Women. That's their spoil. Kidnapping and raping and using women as objects, that was Canaan. That was just the beginning, because their sexual immorality was extensive. But it starts here, how they see women. So Canaan sees women as something to satisfy their desires. So now we've gone from Eglon, who sees food as a way to satisfy his desire, and we come to Canaan, who sees women as a way to satisfy their desire. And then it's not going to, because your sexual desire is never going to be satisfied, then we're going to go on to all of the aberrations of sex in Canaan. So Canaan really stands for all of the sexual immorality that went on, starting with women, using them, and then, of course, you're going to use anything and anyone that you can to get that sexual desire met more and more. So that's the culture they're in, but it's also the culture they decided to follow. They decided to look at that because it tells us that Israel did evil again. And what has happened right before they decide to do evil again? Ehud has died. So remember, Ehud is the judge from the last couple chapters. He's died. And now they seem to need someone to help them along. Otherwise, they're going to turn. Their magnetic north is going to make them shift again and look toward the culture. Interesting here of what happens with Israel. Because anytime you seek power, power is always going to create hierarchy. And in hierarchy, there's going to be a bottom man, right? In fact, there's really only one top, and everybody else is going to be oppressed. Everybody else is going to be used in order for that man to stay on top or get on top. So we see Israel facing toward power. And this is what it looks like when that happens. It says that the highways were deserted and travelers went roundabout ways, kind of secret ways. So it was unsafe. It was an unsafe place to be. When I read that, I think of what if you were in Iraq right now or what if you were in Syria right now. And I think about that a lot because both of my kids say, oh, if we could just go back now. Both of my kids lived in Syria. And I think, are you nuts? And my only confidence is the government won't let them go back. But they would love to go back because, you know, they love people there. But you know how it is in Syria right now? Really horrible. It's unsafe. No matter where you are, it's unsafe to be. That's how it was in Israel then, because of the power struggle that was going on. It tells us that the peasantry ceased. Now, we need to back up. Translation's not great there. The peasantry, whenever it talks about peasantry, what it's really talking about is the places of unwalled cities. So the villages that have no walls, that's what it's talking about. And it's actually talking about the fact that the leaders have left. So the leaders of the unwalled villages have left. So they start to paint it as the peasantry has ceased. The peasantry hasn't ceased. It's the leaders have ceased. It's the leaders of unwalled villages have ceased. In other words, they have abandoned their leadership in the fight to keep open spaces. Now, that's physically happening, but spiritually that's happening. Because remember what an image bearer does? He makes sure that their space, freedom, this is how people multiply to flourishing. So an image bearer always makes sure there's openness and space because God's power is always with vulnerability. It's, I'm going to share this. It's freedom. It's choice. And what the leadership is doing in Israel is they're giving up on that. We're not going to fight for that. We're going to allow the power structure to take over. So that's what's happening. Whenever you see peasantry cease, that's what's happening. Is think about these beautiful villages that have no walls and no defenses, because this is the place where you flourish when there's no walls and boundaries. And the leadership has given up, and they've abdicated. And so they're out there on their own. So that's what it means by peasantry has ceased. And then we notice that not a shield or a spear is to be found in all of Israel. So think about what position you're in. How much choice do you have as an Israelite under the Canaanite rule? You have no spears, no shields. How much choice? There's no choice, right? Absolutely no choice. You are going to do what the power structure says. But always remember, They got there because they chose to follow and idolize power. Just like in Egypt, all that, those 400 years they were slaves, they weren't victims. They got there because they chose to give into whatever idolatry was going on in Egypt. We talked about that in Exodus. Now we see it again here. So we got to get rid of the idea of victimhood here, because they've chosen to follow the gods from among the gods of the people they lived among. They didn't destroy the Canaanites. They lived among them. They saw their power. They started following it. So all of these things that are happening in Israel, what the culture looks like right now for Israel, what its state is right now, is an indication that they are allowing the culture of power to dictate their identities. They're not fighting for an identity of image bearing. The culture says, follow whatever makes you happy, which is the first couple of chapters of Judges. Does the culture say, follow what gives you power, what gives you control? Do any of those sound like today's culture? Yeah, both of them, right? When you follow those cultures, those cultural gods, those cultural idols of either being happy, being self-satisfied, or having power, having control, you are eventually going to be submissive to that. So you're not going to end up at the top. Always everyone's going to end up at the bottom and be oppressed by that. So Judges tells us, what is it? I'm trying to think of where, what verse it tells us it's in chapter 5. So in chapter 5, Deborah says, why are they in this position? Chapter 5, verse 8. What does chapter 5, verse 8 say? Yeah, they chose new gods. They chose that. Again, they're not victims. They chose this. The word chose there is actually pretty strong, because the word chose there actually means that they took time to test out whether this god of power would be beneficial to them. They actually tested the gods on that. They actually looked and said, wow, you know, that looks pretty good. I'm going to taste that. I'm going to see. And they tasted it and thought, you know what? This does give me power. This makes me feel good. This makes me get control. We like this. We think this is a good way to go. Does that sound like anybody else you know in the Bible? How about us going all the way back to Genesis 3? Yeah. It's exactly the same story. Eve looked at the tree. I'm going to test this for myself to see. God's already told her it's not good for you. God's already told them the gods of the Canaanites aren't good for you. We're going to test and see on our own. That's what this word means, to choose. It actually means to test out. Let's test out. And so Eve takes the apple and she says, oh, my eyes were opened. And they were open to now evil as well, which is what's happening with Israel too. So they chose new gods. They judged what was good for themselves. They did not listen to God. God had already told them, these are not good for you. They will not bring you life. Well, I want to find out for myself. Does that ever happen with our kids? Right? We tell them, it's not good for you. It's not good for you to run into the street. But they're going to test it, right? They're going to test those boundaries. What about us? Do we do that? Yeah, we know some things God has told us that's not good for you. And we are not quite sure that that's true. We're going to test.
So this is very metaphorical as a reflection of the human being worshiping idolatry of life and not learning from the past stories over and over again, and just repeating these same errors, and God saying, okay, fine. Mm-hmm. You got to do it again. Mm-hmm. I'll sit here and wait until you figure it out.
Right, yep. But he'll use that, right?
All people.
Yeah, of course it does. Of course it does. So they're idolizing power. I want to just kind of slow down here and talk about power. So the power they're talking about is the power when we think power, the ability to control things. Really, it is getting your picture accomplished. That's what power is. So I forgot to ask you the question, but if you were to have a superpower, so we talk about these comic book superpowers, what superpower would be useful for you? Just shout some out.
Super energy.
Mm-hmm. Heather, what good would super energy be for you, for your life?
I could do stuff.
You could do stuff.
More stuff.
Okay, you can do more stuff. Okay. What else?
Freezing time.
Freezing time. Okay, so that would be a superpower. So
not healthy. I wouldn't choose it, but you said what's most useful?
Yeah. Okay.
Freezing time.
Okay, freezing time. What other superpowers?
Transport, like be here to there.
Yeah, to fly.
And why would that be helpful for your life?
Because you can get there faster and get it done. And you don't have to wait. And you don't have to sit.
You don't have to drive.
Journey.
Okay. Oh, isn't that interesting? Yeah. What else? What other superpowers would we really like to have?
And be in more place than one.
Boy, it sounds like everybody kind of wants to do the same thing.
It's a time issue.
It is a time issue, right? So, boy, wait till we get to the end of Judges and we're going to really talk about time. So these superpowers, and when you think about that, we all have something we wish we could do so that we accomplish our picture, right? That's always what it's about. That's what power is about. So we accomplish our picture. That's what power is always about. And in order for us to accomplish our picture, it's going to take actions. And the actions are always, whether we agree or not, whether we think that's true or not, whether we're really, really nice about it, it's still an action of force. It's going to mean force against others. It's going to mean containment. It's going to mean narrowing. It's going to mean managing. It's going to mean seeing people as tools to get my picture done. That's what when we talk about worldly power, the power that we want, the ability to control, it means all those things.
But Jill, I didn't write that for my power. I wanted to be able to heal broken hearts, broken relationships, and broken bodies.
Okay. So we'll talk about that when we talk then about God's power, right? Because that's God's power, right?
Yeah.
So that's going to look differently. But the power that we pretty much underneath almost all of us have a desire for is the power to be able to control things to get our picture done. Even if our picture is really a great picture. Right? We want to be able to do that. And we want to be able to do it the way we want to do it. And the way we think is good.
And isn't there some truth to the fact that even if we feel we've achieved the picture, there's then another picture?
Of course.
So this idea that, you know, and I think about this all the time, but somebody recently said this to me in these words, and it's, well, I don't care about the things I already have because I got them.
Right.
It's the stuff I want that matters, right? This was actually said to me, and I was like, okay.
Yeah.
And I thought about that, and I thought about how the gifts you've been given are not always fully enjoyed, mm-hmm. appreciated, you're not thankful for it. It becomes a thing that you place on the wall.
Right.
So the idol is what continues to draw you out
right.
and to tell you that what you have is not enough.
Right. Exactly.
And what you are is not enough.
Exactly. That's exactly what it is. But we will still strive, right, to get, because we keep thinking it's just around the corner. It's just
right.
on the
so
other.
So the Israelites would deal with oppression for all those years
yeah.
because they think it's okay because
right.
I'm almost there.
Right. I'm almost there.
But
yeah.
I'm getting like
right.
seriously cremated here.
Right.
And I'm
right.
rolled out.
Right. right.
So it's a very bloody, evil depiction of, I think, things that we just do without thinking every moment of every day.
All the time. We're always going toward individual gain. Now, and I say that, and a lot of you will protest and say, oh, but that's, I want good for my family.
That's still.
But that's your picture. Because mm-hmm. the good for your family, I mean, think about it right now. paint a picture of what you think is good for your family. It's beautiful, isn't it? There's no struggles in it. There's no hardship, right? That's the picture.
A money tree growing in my backyard.
Yeah, I mean, it's everything. There's no health problems. There's nothing. And to you, that's a good picture. But we read scripture, that's not God's picture. Because that means I can be independent. That means I don't need others. That means if I don't struggle, I have no need for anyone else. And yet, if we're created in the image of God, we're created community, cohort, Trinitarian, then that's not good. So see, our pictures are so skewed because we are led by our psyche and our bios. We don't want to feel pain. We don't want to feel emotional pain or physical pain or any of that. So our pictures are never the right pictures. Power will always demean and devalue. They will always do that. Now, we're going to get really personal here and think about power. How I see power, how I idolize power, where I see that. So I want us to think about at home, at church, at work, in the world. We'll start with the world because it's easier, but it's just as potent. I want you to think about what you think the purpose is of the jewel checkout lady. What's her purpose? What?
Collect your money.
To collect your money. Anything else?
Transaction.
Yeah? Who's she working for?
Jewel.
Really? Is that what you really think?
Me.
Yeah, that's what we really think, right?
She's working for what?
She's working for me. I'm paying her, so she needs to do a good job of what she's doing for me, right? The bag. Oh. Believe me. She charges you wrong. She is not paying attention to you and paying attention to the bag boy. She's, what?
It's slow.
Slow. What's your first thought?
Oh, man.
Hey, lady. Get with it, right? This is how we think. I've heard people say, I've said it. Do you remember the big thing about 2 years ago, which I now have to do again, my sprinkling system.
Last year.
Oh, was it last year? Great. Last year.
It's a chronic problem.
Yeah, it is a chronic problem, unfortunately. And I have to redo this. I call my sprinkling system, people to shut off the sprinkling system. Their time to come in Naperville is on Wednesdays. Wednesdays don't work for me. So I call them and say, you know, when can you do it other than Wednesday? We can't. We have to do it on Wednesday. And this is what I said. I'm paying you to do this. You're in business for me. And I didn't think anything of that. Because that's what I believed. I still kind of believe it. Right? Ah. Yeah. And you know what? This is so hard for us that we all think, well, that's true, right? Not in the kingdom. That's not how it works. I had to go back and talk with them. I'm sorry. Is there a way? So we're going to talk about this in just a second. So I look at people in the world as working for me. If I'm paying them, they're working for me. I'm all about transaction, right? I'm paying them, they're working for me. What I'm not seeing them as, who are they created to be? Images of God, reflecting Him in very unique and special ways. Is that what I'm looking for? Is that what I see in people in the world? Not usually. All right, let's bring it down a notch. Let's go to the people at work, the people you work with. And that could be in ministry or your real work or your volunteer work.
Real work.
Yeah. Yeah, that wasn't very nice. Well, we're not even going to go there. Think about that. The people that you work with. How do you look at them? Are they tools to get your picture done? Or are they images of God? Let's think of situations.
Probably
exactly depends on where they are in the hierarchy.
Yes, it does, doesn't it, Susan? What's the difference?
Well, I was thinking back to when I was teaching, so I hate to admit that I look this way, but I probably looked at my peers differently, mm-hmm. as more like we were working together, mm-hmm. but then I had my TAs who worked under me, and I think I saw them more about, you're here to do X, Y, and Z for me.
Yep.
And in this particular way with this attitude. And so
yes.
My bosses, the principal or the administrator, you would see them as, they're one that you're there to serve, or you're supposed to be doing things for them.
Right, right. Okay. Any other examples that we have of how we treat one another, how we really look at them? So most of the time, my guess is, we're all good Christian women, right? So we're pretty nice and gentle with most people. What happens in work if something goes wrong? Somebody doesn't do their job right. What are you thinking? If it affects you, what are you thinking?
It's a bad reflection on me.
Yeah? They're not pulling their weight, right?
Why are they here?
It's a trust issue.
Yep, it's definitely a trust issue.
Okay, if I were to think about what they maybe have going on in their life that caused that to happen, because that's not something that normally happens.
Okay, what if it is something that normally happens, though, for them?
I don't know.
They need to be kept accountable.
Make sure we do what she tells us.
So we have three coworkers here, I think. So maybe we're on touch on that. I want us to really honestly think about that. I'm not going to give you all my examples. I have way too many examples. And I worked in ministry. So it was a real job and ministry.
I also know how I manipulate people in order to get what I want, even if they are, especially if they're a person above me. Mm-hmm. I make sure that they're liking me, that they're on my side, because I'm going to get what I want much more easily if they like me,
yes.
than if I exactly. am abrasive.
Exactly, exactly. Anybody else do that?
Mm-hmm. I was just going to say, last year when you shared your story about the, I think it was the sprinkler system or whatever, that during that time I was having my hardwood floors done. So then I was all of a sudden going through the struggle of my whole attitude and... But then suddenly I found out if I was really nice, I got more. So then that opened a whole new problem.
Yes, exactly.
Because now am I going to just start doing that with people in another manipulative way?
Exactly. This is how insidious it is for us. We follow the God of power. Mm-hmm. The power of... I'm going to tell you right now. I shouldn't say this because if legal, anybody finds this out. I'm going to court today over my traffic accident. I'm literally thinking all last night and this morning, what should I wear to make sure that the judge sees me as responsible? Literally, I'm thinking this. I should wear red because that... No, I should wear red. I'm thinking this, and I'm struggling with myself and God. Look, God, I'm sorry. You've got it. I'm sorry. I should... And then I'll get back to what... How can I... I should bring everything. I should make sure I'm all red. All of this so that he sees me in a better light, right? We do this all the time. As a speaker, you're taught that. You're taught what to wear, kind of how to do certain things so that they listen to you. That's power. That's what we're talking about. Now let's bring it down even farther. We can bring it to church, but even farther, let's bring it to our family. How do we seek for power within our family? How do we seek for, let me use this word, control for our in our family?
Mood.
Mood. Oh, that's like number one, right? So easy to just use your mood to manipulate, to manage, right? How many of you use your mood to manage? Oh, only one of us. Of course, we all do. We make sure that our picture gets done by the use of power. All the powers we have. Here are some red flags to know whether you're using power or not, whether you're actually walking toward power, that kind of power, or not. I tell instead of ask. Now that's remember, that was a lesson in Matthew. If I tell instead of ask, you know I'm trying to use my power. If I criticize instead of exhort. And when I say exhort, that means to encourage to action. That means I point out their ability to do something great. Criticize instead of exhort. Our old-fashioned one, expectations versus expectancy. Expectations, this is the way the picture needs to be, and this is what I'm expecting you to do. Expectancy is, I'm looking at you going, I know there's great things in you. Where are they? I'm going to look for them. I'm looking for the great things in you rather than you accomplishing my picture. And this is very similar, compliance versus conversation. I'm just looking for you to do what I told you to do, rather than have conversation about it. Well, what do you think? How do you think we could take the garbage out better? Maybe we could have a different standard. What do you think? Those are just red flags to show us that we are always walking toward power, because it gets us what we want, and what we want is our picture to be accomplished. Going back now to Israel, that's what was happening with Israel. They saw that power gets their pictures accomplished. We all see this, and we see it all sorts of different ways. Chris, I think that was a great example of, all of a sudden I realized, if I'm really nice to the workers, you know, when we were building the addition and we had all sorts of people come from the city, like, people were telling me, well, you should have a beer for them. You know, you should have a cooler of stuff for them. Just to kind of grease the way. All of that. And we, you know, be sweet and talk sweetly. Those are all ways that we use that. And the reason I wanted to go through that is because I think a lot of times when we talk about idols, gods, we think that's far from us. This is very near us. This is very part of all of us, that we seek power to get our picture accomplished. When I seek power to get my picture accomplished, I am in turn refusing God's kind of power. I'm refusing God's rule, because God's rule is always a rule of vulnerability. So when I gave you those red flags, those tell, criticize, expectations, compliance, those are all power. But when I ask or exhort or have expectancy or converse with someone, that's ruling with authority, with vulnerability. That's giving them a part in the process. Do you see how that's different?
Mm-hmm.
When I want them to comply or when I have conversation, all of a sudden, I've given up some of my power. I've given up to have them come into the situation. That's the difference between power of the world and God's kind of power. When God in Genesis 2 says, and let man rule, that's the kind of rule he's talking about. Rule with vulnerability.
Don't you think you take, your power cue based on what that other person, that relationship or that dynamic with them, that sometimes you can feel like, well, they forced me into this power position because that's how they're, and you just get into this back and forth, or it's just
right.
A circle that just...
Right, which is exactly what Adam said, right? You gave me this woman, so I had to, Yeah, we always, you forced me into this situation here. That's what Adam says. So we know that that's what we all say then. The goal of God's type of power, first of all, he always gives us freedom to accomplish not your picture and not someone else's picture. His picture. because he's the only one who actually knows what the picture is supposed to look like. He's the only one who has the picture of pure shalom. So he gives you freedom, though, to accomplish his picture. His goal is always to achieve shalom for everyone, for the whole world. And his vulnerability is that he's trusting you to join him in working in that. His type of power, his rule with vulnerability, is always redeeming and always revealing of value. So, that's what Israel was choosing against when they were choosing for power. It's what we choose against when we choose to control and use power. The result for Israel was, it says, war is now in the gates. What that means is it's right in your house. You can't ignore it anymore. He has brought it right to the fact that it affects your daily living, that you are going to be pressed now in your daily living in some way or form. You're not going to be able to ignore it. And of course, the response is to cry. And crying, when it uses it this way, is always that vulnerable piece. I can't do this anymore. This isn't giving me life. I'm not going to walk again toward power, at least for this moment. Because we see in Israel, they do it for a moment, and then they go back. So let's now look at the deliverers in 4 and 5. Because we have three deliverers, only one's called a judge, but we have three different ones. And I love these deliverers. They're so interesting. We have Deborah, first of all. Deborah's name means bee. It actually means the characteristics of a bee, the orderly, systematic way that they live, which fits her well because she uses that in her judging. The interesting thing, though, I find about Deborah, more than the meaning of her name, is who she was probably named after. Does anyone know that there was a Deborah in the Bible before Deborah? I didn't even know that either. Deborah, and the reason I only know this because I looked up where it says that Deborah sat when she judged. Where did she sit? Under the palm tree of what? Under the palm tree of Deborah. That's not her. Yeah. Guess what? That Deborah was the nurse of Rebecca. Rebecca, the mother of Israel. So I look at this and I think, oh, Deborah is a nurse to Israel. That's exactly what Deborah is, right? Yeah. Yeah, you're like, wow. Oh, okay. So that's who Deborah is. We know Deborah's a woman, obviously. We know she's a wife and we know she's a mother. Now, think about this in the culture she's in. What is the culture specifically think about women?
Objects.
Objects. They're spoil. They're for me to get my satisfaction from. Nothing else. And so, of course, this is where God brings up two women to deliver Israel. We know that she was both a prophetess and a judge. There was only one other judge that was also a prophet, and that was Samuel, so we won't even talk about him this semester. So this is a very unique position, that she's both a prophetess and a judge. Prophetess means that she spoke God's words. Almost always a prophet, when we think about a prophet, is not so much the foretelling of what's going to happen, it's the warning. A prophet is a warner. A prophet says, you continue to behave this way, this is what God says. That will happen. This is not a good way to live. That's what a prophetess does. And obviously that made her a good judge. She was able to help them. She comes from the tribe of Ephraim. And she, it's interesting, they said, the sons of Israel look to her. Okay, that's amazing that was true. That the sons of Israel, so not just her tribe, but a lot of the other tribes around came to her for judgment, came to her for, could you help us with this dispute? Can you help us make decisions here that would be good? So what we see of Deborah is that she has embraced her identity as image of God and then used her roles to fulfill that image. Despite the fact that during this time, remember, the leaderships have abdicated their roles. So the leaders of Israel the normal leaders of Israel have gone by the wayside. And Deborah is saying, well, just because I'm a woman, or because I'm a prophetess, or because I come from Ephraim, none of those is going to make me not fulfill being the image of God. The image of God always, the image bearers always are there to make room for others to flourish in their naming and tending and multiplying. So I'm going to still do that, and I'm going to use who I am to be able to fulfill that role, or that identity of image bearer. Okay, so that's just a little snapshot of Deborah. Barak, his name means lightning sword. But he's also the son of Abinoam, and his name means father of gentleness and graciousness. So we have this seemingly contradictory person, because if Abinoam is the father of graciousness, that means Barak is gracious, right? Gentle. But he's also lightning sword. He's from Naphtali. And we also know that he has already been directed by God to go and fight. Now, you need to understand that, and probably in most of your Bibles, it probably, in the translation, it probably gave you a footnote. The literal translation is when Deborah says she summoned Barak to go and fight, it actually says she summoned Barak and she said to him, has not God told you to go and fight? So Barak already knows this before Deborah ever says anything to him. So he's already heard this, which tells you something about Barak, right? He's not there yet. Also, the idea about the fact that he is named both grace, gracious, and lightning sword tells you also how God feels about those two. They are not mutually exclusive. This is what we often think. We think to give grace means that we don't fight the idolatry there. But that's not true, because God has it sitting in one person, in Barak. Indeed, grace or gift, it is a gift to be able to fight the idolatry. It's a gift to be able to make space for image bearers to name and tend and multiply. And we only make space by getting rid of idols. So the two are actually perfectly melted in that name. He's also already been promised by God, before Deborah even says, that God is going to hand over to him Sisera and all the troops. He's already going to give them into his hands. Barak already knows this when Deborah summons him. So that's why she summons him. In reality, he should have already been out there. But Deborah summons him. Remember, he's from a different tribe, so she's bringing him into her place of the tree of Deborah and saying, hey, God's already told you this. Why aren't you doing it? What we see here, and this is really important for the whole lesson, is that Barak has already been named with worth. He's already been named with worth, and the way he's been named with worth is that God said, go and fight the idols. You are so valuable to Israel. You are so valuable to the cohort. You have value. So when he calls Barak, in his calling, it is a naming of worth. When I receive my image-bearing identity, when I receive that as a gift from God, I also will begin to identify with the body, with the cohort, right? Because if I am an image-bearer, it means I am reflecting who God is, and God is a member of cohort. He's Trinitarian, right? He's relational. So as soon as I receive the identity as image bearer, I also connect with the cohort. I also connect with others. For Barak, he isn't there yet. God has said to him, you are worthy, Barak. You are worthy to lead people to help the cohort. You have value in holding up the weight and glory of Israel. That's what is said when he's calling him. So for us too, when we're called into battle against an idol, God is naming us with worth. You're worthy to battle the idols to help the cohort. So whether it be an idol in your own life, when I battle an idol in my own life, it makes space for me to name worth in others. It makes space for me to tend others. It makes space for me to multiply others into flourishing, to give them that open space. If I have not received the identity of image bearer, I can't give the identity of image bearer to anyone else. I can't name worth. You're worthy if I haven't received that name of being worthy. Does that make sense to you? Mm-hmm. The interesting thing, the word receive in the Old Testament, every time they want to say receive, they actually use an idiom, and the idiom is to turn your face toward. So when it says, when Aaron blesses and he says, may God shine his face upon you, it's actually, may God receive you. And that's true, right? If Linda wants to give me something and I receive it, do I go like this? I turn and I say, right? I turn. The whole idea of this is turning our face to God, to orient, right? So it's interesting that to receive our identity, to receive our identity as image bearers, we've got to turn to him, right? There's no other way I can be an image bearer. I can't be an image bearer and going on a different path, going toward power. I've got to turn toward him, which is, Barak isn't there yet. He's not turning toward God and receiving what God says, Barak, you're worthy. You're valuable to cohort. He is, he just doesn't believe it yet because he isn't turning to receive that. He's not receiving it. And I think that's, I actually think this is a problem for us. I think we have a hard time receiving the naming of worth in us. Would you agree with that? Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think we have a really difficult time. It's literally just a turn away. Turn toward God's face. And his face is shining toward you. He's turned toward you. And he's saying, look, you're made of reflective material. You turn toward me and you get to see that you are valuable to cohort. You are valuable to the Trinitarian relationship. You're valuable to the world. If we don't receive it, we cannot give it. And that's our whole purpose, is to name worth in others and to tend others. I can't do it if I haven't turned to God and received my worthiness in him. My ability to be useful and helpful to building the cohort, to increasing the court, to building the garden to the city. Does this make sense to you? Mm-hmm. This is what's happening with Barak. He just cannot believe. Think about this. He has been called by God to lead armies, and he can't believe it. But we're gonna look at why. I mean, it's not out of the ordinary that he would be not sure that he can do this. And by the way, it is not only fighting idols in your own life, but sometimes we're called to fight idols in the culture. And when I am called to fight idols in the culture, I get to make space for lots of people to start naming worth in others. It opens up. Kristen, you have a question?
I'm sorry, I'm still stuck on the naming. Can we go back just a bit?
Yeah.
Because I tried to do this with some of the high school girls, and it turned into, I named not just your roles, but maybe it did turn into roles. I don't know. It did not turn into, this is your way of reflecting God. This is how I see God reflected in you. It turned into more, oh, I see these things in you that are good. I don't know. I guess I'm not explaining myself very well.
So what's the question?
So I guess my question is, how does it look? How can I better do it with others?
Where do you think you're going to start?
Myself, I suppose. But when you said turning towards God, I'm thinking, well, how did we not turn towards God when we tried to do that?
Anybody have any thoughts on that?
Does anybody know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, I know what you're talking about. Yeah.
Is it like one of those things where you ended up saying like their roles and not speaking their true identity of image of God? Is that what you're saying?
I mean, we tried to.
No, right. But where then it became like more, not really transactional, but kind of just like, I see you do this. It's good.
Yeah.
That type of thing. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And just not speaking out of like, you are joyful. That is some a way I see Christ in you, or something like that. Because
yeah.
Mm-hmm. I get caught in that too.
What?
The mirror analogy. Yeah, I mean, if you're reflecting God, it doesn't matter what you could do. Mm-hmm. It's what those image, like those. What? How do you define God?
Mm-hmm. Right.
You know, what
the characteristics of God?
Yeah.
Right.
Okay.
Compassionate.
Mm-hmm.
Slow
right.
to anger. Loving.
Mm-hmm. As opposed to saying, like, you are such a good listener to your friends. She could turn away and be like, okay, I need to be a good listener.
Yeah.
As right. opposed to why.
Right.
She's compassionate.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
She's
right. Right.
Humble. I don't know.
Right.
So maybe it's more God's characteristics.
Right.
Than
yeah.
Like
right.
That.
And always in that, there's always that perhaps way of thinking, oh, I just need to be more compassionate. But it always has to start with you have learned how to receive compassion from God,
mm-hmm.
and that's why you're mm-hmm. compassionate.
Maybe you start with your group of girls. I mean, you wouldn't do this with friends that you're just sitting with, but creating a list of characteristics of God.
Yeah, that's
yeah.
what I'm thinking.
Yep,
it's maybe
yep.
a better starting point.
Yep.
And then
right.
when you create that list, then you can then it's
yep.
easy to see that they're reflecting not in themselves,
some
but
great
this is
right.
a list of what we said
right.
God looks like.
Yeah.
These are the characteristics
yeah.
of God.
And the step before this is how you reflect, uh-huh. what are you receiving?
Mm-hmm.
Are you receiving compassion from God?
Yeah.
I can't. I cannot be compassionate, even though it might look like it on the outside, if I'm not receiving compassion from God. If you're always, and Lisa always points this out to me, Mom, you're always so hard on yourself. If you're hard on yourself, you're inside hard on others. You've got to receive, you know, God is gracious to me. God has mercy mm-hmm. for all of my faults and everything, and he's using all of those. If I can receive that, this is so key. It's key for Barak, and it's key for us. I can't go out and fight idols if I've never allowed God to shine on me, right? To shine that mercy and compassion and saying, you are valuable just the way you are, actually. You're valuable, and I'm going to use all of that pieces. So there's a lot about that receiving that Barak had to learn, but God was really gracious in how he brings Barak about. So I think we'll talk more about this, but are you kind of
yeah,
where we're at?
I mean,
okay.
Track, yeah.
You can also use the analogy of the moon. Like if you're like
yeah.
the moon, and what things are you getting, like allowing to get in the way between you and the sun?
Right.
That doesn't allow you to reflect on.
Mm-hmm.
So when God calls us to battle an idol in our life and or in the culture, he will. And let me give you this. He will never call you to battle someone else's idol. He might call you to come with someone when they're battling. But it's not your job to... It's not like... Well, Linda, you have an idol of eating. I know she doesn't, so I can say that. I'm going to battle that idol for you. I'm going to go lock your refrigerator. And I'm going to make sure that David doesn't allow you to buy any more cereal. that's not my job. But sometimes I'm called to be with her when she's battling, mm. right? That looks completely different. We talked about all that last year, what it looks like to be with.
Mm.
But I am sometimes called to battle idols in the culture. And that is going to really be an interesting battle. But I believe that he'll first call you to at least battle one of your idols so that you understand war, that you get taught war. And this is where we get taught war. This is what God is doing, teaching us war, of how to get rid of those magnetic north directions.
So how do you see battling idols in the culture?
Can you think about, so what are some idols in the culture? Let's say oppression of immigrants, right? So maybe I work toward, so this is pretty much what my daughter does for a living, is she battles refugees being low on the hierarchy. She brings them into flat, the same level as we are. So she walks them through it. So it's sometimes it means that you might actually battle, like you might actually try to have laws passed. Mm-hmm. In fact, I think today in the paper there is a thing on, there's a new vote that we're going to take, right, on the rights of victims of crimes.
Right.
Right? Mm. That's a battle somebody entered, right?
Because I think it's easier to battle idols in the culture than it is to battle idols within.
Yeah. Why do you think?
Well, because it's the way that, I mean, it's the way that we perceive being Christian,
mm-hmm.
to tend to those,
yeah.
and help
right.
them to flourish, right?
Right.
So it's easier to do that outside of yourself.
Right.
Yeah.
Less vulnerability, right?
And yeah, and you feel like you're reflecting by
right.
attending to
right.
that.
There's also a lot more temptation in doing it. Because what ends up happening is you getting power from it. You getting, respect, and then you start building that. So there's more temptation in that
mm-hmm.
than there is. So you know, it's one of these, like, harder personally, and yet there's a lot more temptation that you probably don't see in fighting in the culture.
Right. Temptation you don't identify as temptation.
Right, correct.
Because that
right.
is really your
right.
internal struggle.
Correct, correct. Okay, so when God calls you, he's naming worth, but God never calls you to do something. He doesn't call Barak to fight, and Barak is somebody who's been a farmer all his life. Although he called Shamgar, right? And Shamgar used what he had. But he always gives you the ability to do what he's asking you to do. And the ability is always his breath. Right? His breath. So you've got to be breathing his breath. A lot of times his breath is going to come through his body. Most of the time his breath is going to come through his body, which means the cohort, which means other people are actually going to be a part of that. So when he calls you, he says you're valuable to the cohort, which means you're valuable to the world. You're valuable and you have the ability to do so. Now we're going to switch over to Yael. I think a lot of people call her Jael,
yes.
which thinks of Superman, right? Because isn't Superman's
right.
dad named Jael? It's Yael. It's Yael. Christian actually had a friend in high school whose name was Yael. So I've been
I
thinking
know
about
her.
You do?
Yeah,
she's
Sherelle.
Yes.
She's so sweet.
Very cool lady. So Yael, I love this. Yael, her name means climbing goat. Now think about this. She is a Gentile who is arising. She is a Gentile who wants to rise up to her identity as image bearer. That's who Yael is. She is a woman, and she is the wife of Heber the Kenite. Now, you should have remembered something that was put in the beginning of Judges. What do we know about Heber the Kenite? It's part of Moses' father-in-law clan. We know at the very beginning of Judges that the Kenites lived with the Israelites. At the beginning of Judges, it tells us that the Kenites actually began to live with the Israelites. What it means is they became followers of Yahweh with Israel, and they were living with Israel. So we have a tribe that is Gentile, but that is actually followers of God. What do we know about Heber, though?
He separated himself.
He separated himself from Israel. And who did he decide to ally with?
With Jabin.
With Jabin, right? With the Canaanites. So that's where Yael is. Yael is someone who used to live with the Israelites, who was definitely in that worshiping of God culture. And now her husband has taken her and isolated her from Israel and put her in the middle of a place that she is now an ally to the Canaanites. So that's who Yael is. She's separated from Israel. She is also a homemaker. So, and I almost wanted to say she is just a homemaker, right? That's what we say all the time. She's just a homemaker. But you need to understand what a homemaker was for this time. Yael, homemakers, all wives, the homemakers in Israel were the people who constructed the tents. So she actually put up their tent. She built it. She maintained it. Everything. That's
maybe
important.
Maybe she wove rugs, too, because there's a rug that features.
Yep, right. Probably. There. Probably.
Because those tents were heavily woven.
Yes. So that's important for you to know because of what she does. So we know that she is isolated. She's isolated from her own people, the Kenites, and she's isolated from the Israelites.
So the Kenites didn't follow?
No, only Heber separates himself.
Oh.
Only Heber the Kenite separates himself. Yep, yep. He kind of did what Israel did. Hey, it looks to me like the Israelites are very powerful. I'd rather go with the powerful people. That's what he does. Okay. So now we have a picture of the three eventual deliverers. So what's God doing? First of all, we see that it says he sells them into the hands. Well, do we think that's a bad thing? Do we think God is turning his back on them? What do we know? He's giving them what they want. For what purpose? To redeem them, right? To give them the experience that their gods are not going to give them life. This is what you want? I'll let you see that it's not life. And I'm going to let you feel it. And I'm going to let you feel it severely. I'm going to let you feel it until you say, oh, this isn't life. That's why he always waits for their cry. It's not a transaction. It's waiting for them to realize that's not life. But he hasn't abandoned them because he's got a prophetess there, right? He's talking to Israel the whole time through Deborah. He has also already talked to Barak himself. God has already said, Barak, go and fight. Now, here's what you need to understand about the fight that he told them. So it tells us in Judges the plan. So the plan is for the Israelites, remember, they have what? No? They have no chariots. They have no swords or spears or shields. They have no weapons. So he tells the Israelites, go to Mount Tabor. And Mount Tabor is a very, they call it a mountain. It's more of a hill. I mean, it's a large, large hill. So he tells, go to Mount Tabor, start there, and then run down to the plain and meet the army of 900.
Chariots.
Okay, let's think about this. Who has the advantage here?
The Sisera's army.
Sisera's army by a long shot. Israel's small. They're running from a mountain down to the plain. What's the plain good for? Chariots. It's a great place for chariots, right? The chariots have the advantage.
Unless it's wet and soggy.
Yeah. But it isn't, right? It's dry right now. And this is what God is saying to Barak. Now, maybe you have a little compassion for Barak, right? Now you go, oh, well, no wonder Barak isn't facing God. What did God just tell him to do? Go slaughter your whole nation. Go do this. You see how facing God, oh, God has my life in his hands, is really important for Barak. So we understand here that the plan is a pretty scary request. Basically, God's saying, go do the weakest thing you possibly can so that you experience what my power is like. You're going against power that you think is really amazing. Let's give you an experience of my power. It looks like it's a completely ridiculous plan. But so did Jericho. And so did all the plans actually up to this. He promises Barak, he says, now go do this ridiculous plan. I am going to give the enemy right into your hand. And then when Deborah confronts him and Barak is like, what does Barak say? I'm not going unless you go. You got God's voice. You know, I'm not going unless you go. And Deborah says, and remember, this isn't a transaction, but if you don't go, then you're not going to get this. This is just a statement from God. Mm-hmm. If you don't receive the gift of being an image bearer, you can't reflect the glory. Right? If I don't turn to God and say, oh, thank you for letting me be an image bearer, I can't reflect his glory. It's just a statement of fact. If you don't receive, Barak, my naming of worth of you, you haven't received that, well, you can't reflect my glory. That's what he's saying here. When he says, when Deborah says, nevertheless, a woman will have the honor. This is really key for Barak, because he understands now, all of a sudden, with Deborah's help, I'm not receiving what God says I am capable of and who I really am. That I am the image of God. That I reflect him. So it turns for Barak right at that point. He's reluctant to bear the weight of Israel because he doesn't think he can do it, because he isn't turned toward God's reflection in him. So, waking up. The deliverers, what do they do? So what does Deborah do? We see Deborah willing to confront and encourage. This is what exhorting looks like. She exhorts Barak. She says, Barak, God's named you. He says you're worthy, you're valuable here. Go and do it. You can do this. She's willing then to also help Barak when Barak says, I'm not going unless you go. Now, Deborah is a prophetess and a judge. Now, most of the judges were warriors. We don't have that picture of Deborah here. But Deborah says, God has asked you to go battle the idols? All right, I'll be with you in that. She is willing to be vulnerable in that. She wants to bear up the weight of Barak, because that is also bearing up the weight and glory of Israel. We see in chapter 5 that she sings praises. She says, after the battle is done, she knows that it's God's doing, which is pretty cool, because we know that Deborah really doesn't get credit beyond this. That's not who she is. She is an image bearer, and she's so thrilled that God got to be reflected in this battle. She is fully awake to her identity, and she's fully participating in cohort. And this is where I think that image of her being named after the nurse of Rebecca, the nurse of the mother of Israel, this is what she is. She is the mother of Israel here. She is nursing Israel, as the first Deborah did. She is really holding them up and being able to bear their weight. So we know that
so
Deborah...
How does she, in verse 9, when she says, you know, I'll go with you, but the honor shall not be yours, and she talks about how it's in the hands of a woman, it's almost like there's power there that she's saying, you're not going to get it, I'm going to get it. I mean, I know that's
That's her statement. That's her statement to say, look, when you don't receive God's gift of image bearing to you, you won't be able to reflect. You won't get the glory.
Okay.
That's what she's saying to him. That's
okay.
Just how it is.
Okay.
It's not a statement of, since you're not doing this, you're not getting that.
Okay.
Okay? It's not that kind of a statement. Okay. It's a statement of fact. Well, you don't receive it, you don't get to reflect the glory. Okay?
Yep.
And so, yes, when you first start reading that, if you don't know the story, you think Deborah's talking about herself.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
So then you become surprised that, oh, it's Yael, actually.
She's talking about Yael.
Yeah, of course she's talking about Yael. But what she's trying to get Barak to understand is, you might go into battle, but if you don't turn and receive the fact that you're worthy to do this, you're not going to be able to reflect God. It'll be about you. And we see that, right? We see that with Saul, right? With King Saul. He just keeps never turning to God. And so everything he does just never glorifies God. And so we have little David coming and doing just the opposite.
Well, she doesn't say, go in and the honor will not be yours, it will be a woman's. What she said is, go in... and the honor shall not be yours, for the Lord So yeah, she's kind of basically saying, remember,
right, exactly.
He's the one who's, yep, who's going to be victorious, yes, on this journey, not you.
Right. But now we got to think about Barrett, because I think we often think negatively about Barrett, right? But I love the picture that he has about Barrett. He is sandwiched in between two women who have fully embraced and received their identity. And that's God's grace, that he sandwiches them, because now he gets to see on both ends what it looks like to receive the gift of being an image bearer. So we know he won't go into battle because he's not yet convinced that he's worthy. He hasn't turned there. Now, Deborah has just told him, you're not going to get any honor for this leadership. What is Barak's response? Oh, he does respond. What does he do?
Calls people to join him.
He goes into battle and he leads. This tells you why Barak is in the Hall of Faith in Hebrews. With knowing before he goes into battle, he's not going to get any honor for this. Now we know he's turned to God. He's not going in with, well, I'm going to get honor for this. He knows he's not. And now he's still going to go in. Now he's actually, oh, Deborah has helped me see that when I turn to God, I'm able to be who I am. I'm able to reflect. It doesn't matter if I'm getting honor or not. Now I've turned to God. So the fact that the next thing he does is actually calls all the rest. And see how many people is he able to get under him? 10,000. 10,000 Israelites. Which tells you he already had respect, but God has said, look, I'm telling you who you are, and you don't believe it. Look at who you really are. Once he turned, it was a whole new story. So we have Barak going ahead into battle, which in turn encourages others. We have 10,000 men following him. And he follows the direction. And he routs the enemy. And notice how it says he routes the enemy. Two or three times it says, what did he use?
His
sword. It says sword. He uses a sword. Where did he get a sword? Obviously, there were swords somewhere now. He uses his sword. What's his name?
Lightning sword.
Lightning sword. Sword of light. I mean, this all the underneath metaphors are pretty intense here. He routs the enemy, but we have Sisera still fleeing, still running away. And we have him, of course, as we're going to Yael's tent. It's a really beautiful picture, because if he were not the man he was, we would probably have him not doing this. Yael calls him into the tent, right, to show him what's happened. This is the woman who is going to receive the glory for doing this, that Barak originally probably should have had. And he actually accepts the invitation. What's happening here is he is so identified now with cohort that this is like, this is great. I'm going to go in and see what has happened. And Yael, this housewife, this homemaker, has been able to do. So we see a whole different Barak than at first. Being able to receive the invitation of Yael to come in and see what has happened is a beautiful kind of end to Barak's story. And then we also see that Barak joins Deborah in chapter 5 in singing, giving credit to God. He's not moping around that he didn't get credit for it. He's praising God. He's honoring God. He sings about Yael. So it's really cool that Barak here, who had this journey, in the end sings, and he sings several verses about Yael, which is really amazing, because I don't know how many of us would be able to do that. You know, we'd have some of those like, I have a really great story, horrible story about me, feeling like that, like, oh, I'll tell it another time. He's really now taken up his image-bearing identity, making space for others to flourish. It's a beautiful story about that. And the cool thing is, in the end, he actually does get honor, right? He actually does get eternal honor in being named in Hebrews as these great men of faith. And I love that Barak's in there, because it shows us that faith isn't immediately trusting God. It's the journey, right? It's the journey of, and then finally receiving his identity, which helps him to be able to be reflective of God. So Yael, we see Yael using her position. She is in perfect position to be able to invite the enemy, right, into a trap. She uses her tools and abilities to kill the enemy. So her tool, her homemaking tool, is like our Mixmasters, is a tent peg. That's her homemaking tool, because that's what she does. She puts up tents. So I think a lot of times if people read this and they go, how in the world was she able to pound a peg through someone's brain? Well, she did it all the time. Not through someone's brain, but through the ground, right? I mean, this was just a normal tool. This was her, you know, Teflon pan. So she did that. And I love the fact, yes, Maida.
He says, give me a little water to drink, for I'm thirsty, and she gave him milk.
Yeah.
What's the significance
Well, what
of
do you, well, we don't do it anymore,
tired?
But yeah, exactly. He's really tired, and warm milk soothes him.
Yeah.
It's a nice soothing. Yeah. So she gives him exactly what she has, right? As a good hostess, you would give somebody something that would be soothing. You know, he's been running, he's in battle. I love that she calls out to him. What does she call out to Sisera? Sisera's running.
She says, my master.
Yeah, my master what?
Turn aside.
And?
Don't be afraid.
Don't be afraid.
Afraid.
Okay, guys, you should laugh there. This little housewife is coming out the door, and this commander of these thousands of armies is running, and she says, well, Sisera, don't be afraid. I mean, it's kind of, God has a great sense of humor. It's just this turning of, it's this big commander who has everything, you know, at his, he's got all the power, and she has none. Mm-hmm. But in reality, God's power is greater than any man's power. Mm-hmm. And so the do not be afraid should switch you to that. Do not be afraid. She's not afraid. She is in enemy territory. She is all alone. She is not with the Israelites. She's not with the Kenites. And she is alone going against the Canaanites. But she knows her identity as image bearer. And she knows that who God has made her and the place God has brought her is all for fulfilling image bearing. It's all for making space so that others can flourish. It's all for making space so that Israel can flourish. And she knows that. And it's why she can go out without fear. And she can go and do this. She knows that the roles and places that God has brought to her are specifically to fulfill her identity as image bearer. That's what we should know. No matter where we're at, who we are, what roles we have, they are all specifically made for us to fulfill image bearing, to make space for others to flourish, to be able to name worth, to be able to tend. Exactly where we are. We don't have to change anything to do that. So she's also very vulnerable, because she now, after she kills Sisera, she invites Barak into her tent. Now think about this. She's an ally with the enemy. What does Barak know about her? That she's an ally with the enemy. That's all he knows, right? He doesn't know she's killed her, Sisera. But she's willing to be really vulnerable, because she walks out to Barak and says, come on in. I mean, Barak's response should have been to kill, right? To kill her. She's an ally with the enemy. Both of them are in this place of so turning to God that they can do this and be vulnerable. I could be wounded here, but I am so concerned about Israel having space to be image bearers that they do that. So we see that she is fully participating in cohort, bearing the weight and glory of Israel. Yeah, Judy.
I was just
wondering, he it says all the army were in a sense dead, and he just fled. He left his chariot and ran. Sounds like he was a coward.
Yeah. Yes, exactly. Not only that, in Middle Eastern culture, that was illegal to do. In battle, for you to run into a woman's home. That was absolutely illegal. So he is, yes, big time coward. Which again, real the power of the world is cowardly. It's all about getting what I want, and I'm going to avoid anything that's going to be hard, right? I'm going to make sure I'm taking care of me. Because that's what real power, the power of the world is. So yeah, that's exactly what that is for him. Israel is awakened. And so we have the Song of Deborah and so many pieces in it. She mentions Sinai in there, which is really beautiful because they are shaken into remembering their marriage vows of Sinai. Remember, the covenant is a marriage thing at Sinai. That shaking, it says this Sinai, it's like this situation we're in has shaken us to remember our vows. And it's waking Israel up to who they are. And the people now are freely choosing. It says they're volunteering. They're freely choosing to follow God's lead. But what caused them to freely choose? Being severely oppressed. So do you see what God does? Mm-hmm. Yes, he allows severe depression in our life. He brings it. He says, that's what you want? I'm going to give that to you because it will bring you to a place that you'll freely choose my path to life, my image-bearing gift to you. And the leaders then start leading, and we have some of the leaders start coming up. And it says the people become warriors instead of victims now. So we have five tribes following Barak and Deborah. We have Zebulun and Naphtali, Ephraim, Benjamin. When it says Machir, that's a part of Manasseh, and Issachar. And it says Zebulun and Naphtali despised their lives even to death. They have seen that this road to power is not life. They are willing to risk everything because they know Israel needs to get out of being subjected to worldly power, an idol of power. But there's still some of Israel that's slumbering. And so we have these four tribes that have different responses to it. Interesting. I'm trying to think in my head, but I think all of these tribes, visually I can see them, all of these tribes are really close to the enemy. Pretty amazing. So we have Reuben. Reuben's divided. He says he searches his heart. He's thinking about it. Should I join the fight or not? Oh, I just can't decide. Will it be worth it for me? What's the benefit? There's no urgency to him. He's just going to debate about it all the time to the tribe of Reuben. Gilead, Gilead just doesn't see a need. Yeah, Canaanites aren't a threat to me. We're fine. We're going to just be complacent. No big deal. Dan is busy with business. They're busy making a profit for themselves, so that they're not going to do this. I hope this brings words of Jesus to you. Asher says, I'm comfortable at the seashore here. At home, it's comfortable here. I'm not willing to fight and give up that. It's not time for me. Do we have any words of Jesus when somebody says to him, he says to them, come follow me? And then they say, well, wait.
The rich young leader.
I have things at home that I need to do. I need to bury my father. I've got business that I need to take care of. I need to take care of my house. And he says, take up your cross and follow me and leave that behind.
Didn't they complicate it by intermingling and maybe intermarrying and that caused all of that? I can see how that would make it so much harder.
Right.
Because you have these now people that are in your
family. In your family, Which is exactly why God said, don't intermarry. It's going to make it so hard for you. Mm-hmm. Don't intermarry. I'm trying to give you what's going to make it easier for you, and I'm giving you the choice. Mm-hmm. Yes. So that definitely made it hard for them. Here's an interesting thing. All these ways of these four, Reuben, Gilead, Dan, Asher, being complacent, with having no urgency, looking for a profit for themselves, being busy, being comfortable. Those are all ways of refusing the gift of being an image bearer. Lack of urgency, complacency, all of that. Because all of those are, well, there's no urgency about fighting my idols. It's not a big deal. Yeah, we all have idols. It's not a big deal. Well, but I'm busy doing this. I'm busy doing ministry. So, you know, idols can wait. You know, it's not right now. You know, I don't have too many problems with idols. You know, that all of those are refusals to receive your image-bearing identity, to say, I am an image of God. I'm reflecting God. The first thing I need to do is get rid of those idols. I need to make space so that I can name words, so that I can be an image-bearer, and so that others can do so as well. It's an avoiding of vulnerability, which is exactly what we said the definition of idols is. Idols are always things that promise you power without vulnerability. And that's what's happening here is they like the power they have of being comfortable, of, you know, not having to get into it right away, all of that. They don't want to open themselves up of being wounded because they know it's going to be for others' sake. And that's really, they're about themselves. So what's God doing here? Finally, he's leading a free people. He's leading a free people to fight and take up their identity as image bearers. And they are choosing freely because of oppression. And I can't say that more forcefully. The oppression was there so that they could actually make the choice on their own to follow God, to be image bearers. And here's where we figure out what happened with the battle. It tells us a couple places in Judges 5 that the heavens poured, the clouds dripped, the mountains quaked, thunderstorms, great, so that the whole plain valley, the Kishon is a very small river, but the valley there is completely flat. And when that Kishon overflows, the whole plains get muddy. The chariots are already in there. What does this sound like? Sounds like Egypt again, right? It's exactly the picture. God causes everything to rain and all the chariots, 900 chariots, get stuck. Israel is able to defeat them, not only defeat them, but now they have weapons because they're all just sitting there. So we see God provides them with victory in an amazing way that wouldn't have seen. You wouldn't have foreseen when God says, all right, do this crazy plan here. And he awakens the Israelites to remember who you are. Remember that you are my chosen people, a royal priesthood, my image bearers, so that you can go out and give that to the world and they can pick up their image bearing identity. And what else is God doing? He's giving grace to Barak. He sandwiches him in between these courageous image bearers, which reminds him of the truth. Arise, Barak. You have an identity that's being brought back to life here, given new life. You're not alone. The Lord goes before you. And so it ends. I love that it ends this way. Judges 5:31. It ends with, let me read it specifically here. But let those who love him be like the rising of the sun in its might. We've been talking about arising, awakening to who you are. That's exactly what it's talking about. Arise, wake up to your identity as an image bearer. This is where the real power comes from to restore the world. That God's image bearers will receive that gift of being image bearers. That they will begin to name and tend and multiply, making space for others to flourish. Arise, like the rising sun in its might. And as soon as I read that verse, I could not help but think about Malachi, where it talks about the Messiah to come. The prophecy of the Messiah to come will be, it's almost the same verse. For those who fear my name, the Son of Righteousness will rise with healing in its wings. And that's a prophecy about Christ. I think we've talked about that, right, in Matthew. That the Christ will be the first fruits, right? He will be the one to rise and show us that our identity is being renewed. our identity as image bearers is being renewed. And that when we embrace and receive that identity as image bearers, healing comes. First through Christ, and then through us as we image bear. And we talked about this, that in Revelation 22, when it talks about what the city, the garden city, is now going to look like, it says that there will be the tree of life on each side of the river. It's referring to us, actually, in the tree of life. We become trees of life. And what are the leaves meant for of our tree? Healing of the nations, of the world. It's this full circle. You as identity of image bearers, you are worthy. You're worthwhile for the cohort, for God's people. And God's people are worthy for the whole world, for all the nations, to bring the healing of that psuche and bios brought back together with the Zoe. Christ brought the Zoe opened up again, and we're the ones to show them, hey, it's accessible. You can do it. But we can only do that when we receive that identity as image bearers, when we hear God say, you're valuable to the cohort. You're valuable to the people of God. You're valuable to the whole world as you name worth, as you receive your worth that I'm giving you, and then you give it out, naming worth, intending, and making space for others to flourish. So, Father, we thank you that you, wow, that you would be so vulnerable with your own power, that you would share it with us, that you would give it to us, and also give us the choice to turn away from it or not. Father, I pray that this week that we would be able to identify the places where we're turning away and looking toward power of the world, trying to control, trying to tell people what to do, trying to get others to get our picture fulfilled. Would you give us eyes to see that? And Lord, the minute that we see that, would your spirit remind us to arise, to turn our face towards you and receive your words of, you are worthy. You are my image bearer. You are reflective of me. Go out and fight. Father, in your power, in your glory, and in your mercy, may we go today. In Jesus' name, amen.
Go forth into the world in peace, rejoicing in the power of the Spirit.
Thanks be to God.